We'll call to order the meeting of the Agricultural Rural Development Committee, February 16, 2005, the hour of 2:30 p.m. having arrived. We will start our meeting out today, but we will interrupt when we do have a quorum. We do not have a quorum quite yet. We should receive that pretty soon here. We have with us today, we don't have any bills up today, but we do have an overview of the pesticide registration process. We have Ann Lindsay from the Office of Pesticide Programs, United States Environmental Protection Agency from Washington, D.C. here. And then we have Paul Lamont from the Environmental Response and Enforcement Section Manager for the Department of Agriculture. That's the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. So we have a statement. There's two statements in your packets, members.
I'm with you.
And we'll be working off, Ms. Lindsay will be working off the shorter one. And what we're going to do, she basically has two sections that she'll present today, and we're going to hold off any questions until she's done with the first section, then we'll entertain questions, and then after that she will finish her presentation. We'll have questions, and then Mr. Lamont will make a few remarks. Just so everyone knows, there were some groups, as I said yesterday, that wished to testify today also regarding the registration process. Since Ms. Lindsay came all the way from Washington, D.C., we're giving her the entire format today, her and the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. We will provide equal time to various groups that have maybe some different views on the issue, and we would be happy to do that. So no one's been shut out of the process. We are just going to give them a full hearing time. We'll give them equal time on another day. So that being said, do we have a quorum at this point? Not quite, we're pretty close. Yeah, that works, doesn't it? Magnets here. We'll officially call the meeting of the Agricultural and Rural Development Committee to order. Representative Conan moves the minutes of Tuesday, February 15, 2005. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none. Representative Conan renews his motion that we pass the minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have before us, we can bring to the table Ms. Ann Lindsay from the Office of Pesticide Programs, United States Environmental Protection Agency, to make your presentation. Again, I'd like to let her about halfway through. We're going to talk about two different things here. The first, I believe, will be the overview of the pesticide programs and then how the registration works and all those types of issues. And then we'll have some questions. And then after that, we'll be going into atrazine specifically. Atrazine seems to be the hot topic around here lately. I know yesterday on my, just so the members of the Ag Committee know, the ethanol bill that passed out here unanimously went to the Environment Policy Committee yesterday. And we didn't talk so much about ethanol, but we talked about atrazine, and then after we wasted a lot of time talking about atrazine, which had nothing to do with the ethanol bill, the amendment that was presented was ruled out of order. It wasn't even close to the section of statute, so I think the chairman appropriately went by Mason's and made his ruling on that. So that's just a little update on the ethanol bill. It now goes to civil law. It seems like there's a magnet. If it says David's on a bill, it just kind of goes to civil law. Isn't that something, how that happens? I hate it when that happens. But we'll go to civil law and we'll present our case there too. So, with that being said, welcome to the great state of Minnesota. We're happy to have you here today. And if you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, and then provide your testimony.
Yes, I'm Ann Lindsay, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Pesticide Programs.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I want to start out, first of all, by offering my thanks to this committee for the opportunity to testify today. As the chairman's already indicated, I've provided a longer written statement describing our regulatory process for pesticides, as well as our evaluation of the herbicide atrazine. And what I'm going to do now for the next 20 minutes or so is present a summary of that statement, but there are lots more details in the longer one. EPA has a very highly regarded program for evaluating pesticide safety. Our reputation rests on our world-renowned expertise in the science of pesticide risk assessment. Our approach to decision-making is widely considered to be a model for transparency and openness. we make regulatory decisions consistent with scientific information and that are protective of public health and the environment. Unfortunately, certain mischaracterizations of our regulatory process, particularly with regard to atrazine, are circulating in a variety of public venues. These mischaracterizations call into question both the scientific soundness and the integrity of our work. Since public confidence is essential to the effectiveness of any regulatory program, EPA welcomes the opportunity to correct the record. The agency has carefully evaluated the available data, including research reporting that very low levels of exposure to atrazine harm frogs. We've also considered whether this research has implications for human health. But before addressing the controversy over atrazine's impact on amphibians, let me review how we regulate pesticides so you can understand our position in the context of our long history of environmental protection. My office is charged with administering the federal pesticide law, the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, under which we must ensure that the use of a pesticide does not cause unreasonable adverse effects on the environment. The safety standard requires EPA to consider not only the potential harm to human health and the environment from using a pesticide, but also the benefits of its use. The agency has broad authority to restrict the way a pesticide may be used in order to lower its risks, and EPA may allow use of the pesticide only if we think the benefits outweigh the remaining risks. The pesticide program includes two major components. Registration, the licensing program that reviews new pesticide products before they enter the marketplace, and re-registration, the program that re-examines previously approved pesticides against current scientific and safety standards. Any restrictions on the use of a pesticide necessary to ensure safe use appears on product labels. State lead agencies like the Minnesota Department of Agriculture enforce proper use of pesticides. Paul Lamont, a pesticide regulatory official from Minnesota Department of Agriculture, is here with me this afternoon to help explain their role in pesticide regulation within the state of Minnesota. Both the registration and the re-registration programs for evaluating the safety of pesticides rest on the same two fundamental principles: basing decisions on sound science and making our decisions through a process that is transparent and open to everyone. Under the pesticide law, pesticide companies, the manufacturers, shoulder the cost of performing the safety studies on pesticides that are required by EPA. EPA regulations establish a rigorous battery of tests necessary to gain approval for a pesticide. A typical agricultural pesticide must undergo over 100 different tests to characterize its potential to harm humans, wildlife, plants, and to evaluate its fate and movement in the environment. The pesticide companies submit these studies for review, and the agency uses these and other scientific data to develop detailed risk assessments for every use of each pesticide. If a test is not scientifically sound, or if EPA simply needs more information, EPA may require a company to conduct additional studies. Further, because of the critical role that scientific data play in our decision-making, the pesticide law requires registrants to report all information relating to potential adverse effects of their products on human health or the environment to the agency. So, for example, if there were new research that were conducted that shows potential adverse effects, the registrant must submit that data to us. EPA holds itself accountable to the public for ensuring the quality of our scientific risk assessments. We reach our conclusions through a systematic, objective evaluation of all relevant information that uses scientifically peer-reviewed, documented procedures at each step. EPA looks at all the available scientific data from every source, not just the data we get from the pesticide registrant, and we look closely at every study. The first question we always ask is whether the results are scientifically sound. To assist in this review, we have issued both guidelines that provide instruction about how to actually conduct the different types of studies we require, and we've issued good laboratory practice regulations that describe procedures to ensure high-quality data from laboratory studies. We also have a laboratory inspection program that monitors testing facilities for compliance with our good laboratory practice requirements. If we have any questions at all about the integrity of a given study, we review the underlying raw data from the laboratory, going back to the test facility if necessary to inspect lab notebooks. We review studies to determine what levels of a pesticide will remain in the environment after use and how those levels compare with doses that could harm humans or the environment. The reviewer double-checks the analysis reported in a study and compares results from one test with other studies to detect inconsistencies between studies. It is not unusual that EPA will disagree with the conclusions reached by any individual researcher. Then, following agency risk assessment guidelines, EPA integrates the data to evaluate whether the pesticide poses potential risk to humans or the environment. To ensure we reach the best possible conclusions, study reviews and risk assessments undergo scientific peer review. When we encounter a significant scientific controversy, we turn to the statutorily mandated scientific advisory panel for independent, external, expert scientific peer review. This panel is a federal advisory committee and thus, by law, must comply with requirements for balance, objectivity, openness, and transparency. The Government Accounting Office, which reports to the Congress of the U.S. government, has evaluated the panel, along with many other scientific peer groups, and has concluded that the scientific advisory panel that serves us in the pesticide arena is one of the best in the business. In addition, the Office of Government Ethics has also reviewed and commended highly the operations of the scientific advisory panel. Beyond sound science, which is the fundament of our work, we also believe in the necessity of an open and transparent process. By open, we mean that everyone at any time can provide information for consideration and everyone may comment on our proposed decisions and the reasons for them. To make comment opportunities meaningful, our process has also got to be transparent. When we say transparent, we mean that all of the information that we have considered and the way that we analyze that information is available to the fullest extent permitted by law to everyone. In re-registration, we typically provide several opportunities for comment on our work. These include chances to comment on our preliminary assessment of a pesticide's risk, a chance to comment on our written response to the public comments that we received, and finally, a chance to comment on our revised risk assessment based on all of the information before us. We also invite comment on what measures may be needed to address any risk concerns. We may hold public meetings for interested stakeholders to explain our positions and to receive input. Finally, we document all of our conclusions in a registration eligibility decision or interim registration eligibility decision document. These documents contain our final risk assessment, our conclusions regarding whether the pesticide meets the standard for registration, and if not, what regulatory measures would be necessary to mitigate identified risks. And I think at that point, you've asked for me to stop and see if there are questions.
If we have any questions from anyone. Representative Pennis?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one of the questions I have on the when the pesticide company does the work with labs, are these independent labs, and who is it of their choosing? Are they ones that the EPA recommends?
Ms. Lindsay?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Penis. These labs can be either labs that are actually part of the registrant's business. They have labs that are within their own commercial enterprise. They can be commercial testing laboratories. They could contract with university researchers. So they're not in the sense that they're, for instance, governmental. They're not government labs. Mm-hmm. But that's why we have built the oversight procedures that I've tried to describe for you to make sure that the quality of the work that comes from those labs is beyond question.
Representative Pennis? Okay, Representative Welty?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, how long has this process been in place, this review process of the pesticides?
Ms. Lindsay?
Mr. Chair and Representative, pesticides have been regulated at the federal level under this basic approach since about 1970. Some of the features of openness, the public comment process that I've described, are probably date back roughly 10 years. We've been running our reevaluation program for the older pesticides since 1988 and are about to conclude that in the next couple of years.
Representative Welty.
Thank you. And Ms. Lindsay, my other question would be then, when was atrazine first put on the market?
Ms. Lindsay?
Do you know for sure?
I think I remember the date. Mr. Chair and Representative, I think atrazine was first registered in 1958. That was actually prior to my working at EPA.
Okay.
Or even prior to EPA existing.
That's my birthday. And just to announce, where'd Jennifer go? It's okay. It's her birthday today, so let her have it after committee. Okay. She's really old, too. Okay. I can only say that because she's not in our presence, but it is on the tape forever, isn't it? It's on the tape forever. Oh, boy. Okay, Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Lindsay, then another question just to follow up with that would be, there are some pesticides that are questionable as to whether or not that they affect humans, they affect aquatic life. And what is the protocol for those pesticides that were produced before the 1970s? Are they required to be studied? Have they been studied in the past? Is it only if we detect that those pesticides may cause or may have issues?
Ms. Lindsay.
Mr. Chair and Representative Welty, all pesticides that were first approved for use prior to 1984 are by law required to go through our re-registration or re-evaluation program for what we call older pesticides. So atrazine is one of those, but there are actually over 600 pesticides that are going through that program. That program was put into place in its current form in 1988 by law, and we expect to complete that program for all pesticides that are used in food production by August of 2006.
Representative Welty.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Okay, Representative Moll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for coming all the way to Minnesota, by the way, Lindsay. Question for you about, you spoke on that your department, when doing an assessment of pesticides, will weigh economic considerations in approving them or not, or making recommendations or not. I'd like you to talk a little bit more about, you know, those economic considerations, what kind of power are they actually have in your decision-making process. And for my area in particular, I represent the Northern Lakes area, and so what might the economic implications for my area, i.e. water quality, might not necessarily be as strong for other areas. So how much you look at issues like that, if you, you want to talk about it. Thanks.
Ms. Lindsay.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Moe. As I said, the basic test that our pesticide law gives us for making decisions is to evaluate the identifiable risks associated with the use of a pesticide, and then also to look at what the benefits might be. And historically, that we have defined that as benefits to those who would actually use the pesticide. So if it's an agricultural products such as atrazine, it would be primarily the benefits to food production and to farmers who are engaged in that practice. Most pesticides, and you can tell this by the name, are actually designed to have an adverse effect on a pest. So there are some exceptions where the mode of action is not toxic, but the bulk of pesticides, they're designed to kill something that people want to get rid of for whatever reason. And they can be public health pests, they can be weeds, they can the vast range of things. That is the basic reason for the pretty elaborate and sophisticated evaluation that we do of the risks of a pesticide, because if something is designed to have an adverse effect on one species, there is a possibility that it could have an adverse effect on another, particularly if you don't use it with great care and caution. However, when we do our risk analysis, oftentimes we find that when we look closely at what the risks are, we look at the level of exposure, we may realize based on that that the level of exposure that will occur from use of the pesticide is way below the level of where you would be concerned. In that case, our analysis of the benefits is likely to be relatively limited. We know that, for instance, a farmer will need to do weed control if they're growing corn or soybeans or whatever, and we may not do a detailed analysis. On the other hand, if we are looking at a pesticide where the very large risk concerns, and I'll take an example actually from a long time ago that is familiar to everyone, DDT, we will go through extraordinarily detailed analysis of the benefits, and that's really to elucidate very carefully and reliably both what are the real benefits and to make sure that we haven't misunderstood what the benefits are and that we haven't misunderstood how the pesticide is actually used. How pesticide is used actually will affect your risk assessment as well. So we need to know we've got it right. But we also want to make sure that if there are alternatives, you know, is it possible for a user to move to a different alternative that poses less risk? So the degree to which we assess benefits is directly correlated to the level of risk that we find. When the risks are high, we will also do a rigorous and equivalently rigorous assessment of the benefits, and then in the end, we will balance those risks against the benefits. And our goal, frankly, is always to mitigate the risks. We never would like to leave a pesticide on the market that was posing very high risks beyond what people would consider to be reasonable.
Thank you. One last question, Mr. Chairman. So then, back to the example that I was obviously concerned about for our part of the state, how is it conceivable that in your risk assessment process, environmental challenges for the water quality for the fisheries in northern Minnesota, for example, would be a consideration for reevaluation or approval of a pesticide?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Mo. When we're looking at a pesticide, we want to know with a great deal of precision not only what are all of the use patterns, but for instance, if it's corn, where corn is grown in the United States, the different environments in which corn is grown in the United States. So we would be taking into account, as much as I think is humanly possible, differences in the situation, say, in northern Minnesota from dryland farming of corn. And we do that for every use. So if you've got a pesticide that has hundreds of food crops, we look at all of them. And we look at the range, the geography, the climate, the growing practices, everything that can possibly influence the way in which an individual will use that pesticide, and therefore the way in which it can get into the environment and the kind of risk that it could pose. That's one of the reasons, if you look at our reevaluation process for atrazine, you can see that it stretches from 2000, and we expect to complete it in 2006. When you do that kind of an analysis, not just for one pesticide, but for hundreds of them, it's a very... Yes, that would be a word for it. We mean to be very thorough because we know that both human health and the environment is at stake, but we also know that people's livelihoods are at stake. So you don't want to make a decision that's based on bad information, wrong information, gaps that could have been filled if you'd looked for them. You want to know you're doing your job right, and that's what we mean when we say that we're accountable.
Thank you, Ms. Levy. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Pennis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question also has to do with atrazine. I kind of skimmed over what you were going to say a little bit. And yesterday at the hearing, we got harassed to be a little strong, but not too strong, about atrazine. The study done by Tyrone Hayes seems to be going around here a lot. And I hear that atrazine is an endocrine disruptor. No questions, no commas, no nothing. It is. Now, in here I read that you say it is scientifically flawed, that study. Somewhere I read it in here. Okay, thank you for the help. Could you just summarize why, and I do also get the feeling that there is no definite answer, which often is true in the scientific world, I guess, but
Pennis, if we could, I'd like to finish the first half of questions, and then we'll
come back
to your question after she's made that presentation. So,
okay, that's fine.
There'll be quite a few questions about that one. One question I have is you know, so I say don't talk about atrazine. I got a question about atrazine. And the reason is, you know, atrazine's come up with all this stuff. I mean, everybody's talking atrazine. You regulate over, you said 600 pesticides. Was that herbicides too? Or is, when you say pesticides, you mean pesticides and herbicides, so about 600. Is it that atrazine is the most widely used? Or what's the most widely used pesticide or herbicide?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I know absolutely the most widely used pesticide, but atrazine is one of the most widely used pesticides. When we use the term pesticide, we include herbicides in that term.
I mean, why are we picking on atrazine? I mean, name some others that are kind of used quite a bit.
Or pyrophos.
Why aren't we picking on Roundup?
Glyphosate.
I probably shouldn't be encouraging people here, should I? I mean, you see what I'm saying? I mean, you know, it's all about atrazine, but what about all this other stuff out there?
Well, is that a rhetorical question or?
No, it's a real one. I mean, is aren't there some other?
But from my point of view, as a regulator, and that's our job. All of the pesticides that we evaluate, when they go through the regulatory process, receive a high degree of scrutiny. And I would not say that one is singled out over the other. I mean, certainly it's our every effort to be as even-handed with each one as we possibly can be. But there may be
another. And also I said going after Roundup, about 16 cell phones came off. And I'm not sure who they were calling. But any other questions to page 3, right above atrazine? Any questions on what we've gone over so far? Do as they say and not as they do, huh?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Right.
Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many pesticides have you registered at the federal level?
Ms. Lindsay?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Otremba. We actually have in the neighborhood of 20,000 individual pesticide products that are registered at the federal level. Now, many of them contain the same active ingredient, so that you could have, you know, hundreds of products that essentially have the same active ingredient. And I would say that they're in the neighborhood of 1,200 active ingredients approved at this time.
Mr. Chair, do states typically allow all of them in their state, or do they look at the geographics kind of bouncing off of Representative Moe, you know, depending on what the state is like as far as geography?
Ms. Lindsay?
Mr. Chair and Representative Otremba, states under the federal pesticide law have the ability to regulate pesticides within the use of their own state, and they can be more strict than EPA if they choose to do so based on local conditions. They cannot permit broader use, so we set the framework within which states may operate. There are states that have very rigorous evaluation programs, so they will look at the same data that we do, make their decisions about which pesticides they allow on their market. They may impose different requirements above and beyond those which we do. There are other states at the other end of the spectrum that basically require, I think, registration in the sense of they want to know that this product is being sold in their state, but they're not actually doing an evaluation of their own. And then obviously there's states in the middle that they may look at one set of issues closely because that's very important within their state, but rely on EPA's work for other aspects. So each state is actually different in terms of exactly what they do.
Mr. Chair, where does Minnesota rank? Do we accept them all, or do we scrutinize, or?
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir. And then
thank you. Paul Lemont, Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I'll be brief because I don't want to interrupt Ms. Lindsay's presentation, but I figured this question would come up. I think you heard that the EPA probably registers about 20,000. I was given information yesterday that Minnesota currently registers approximately 12,000 of those products. Approximately one-fourth of those products are sanitizers and disinfectants, Lysol and those sorts of products. About 14% of the products registered are used in egg production. So the other types, just FYI, are homeowner, lawn, garden, ornamental, structural, which is exterminator interior, forestry, aquatic, rights of way, swimming pool, spas and hot tubs, preservatives, pets, and livestock. And there probably are a few others. And I'll just finish up here. The leading ag pesticide active ingredient in terms of pounds sold for use in Minnesota is glyphosate, which is Roundup. And that's the pesticide used in Roundup Ready crops.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions before we proceed? Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the witness, when you talk about the risk factors that are under consideration as you go either through the registration or the re-registration process, could you describe what some of those most important risk factors are that the EPA takes into consideration?
Ms. Lindsay?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, yes. We'll, on the human health side, to start with that, we'll be looking at risks from what we would call acute exposure, so that if you touched it, you accidentally drank it, you inhaled it, would it have an immediate toxic effect? We would be looking at effects that might occur over, we call it a subchronic period of time, not an immediate effect, but not a lifetime effect. And then we would be looking at long-term effects that could occur after a lifetime of exposure. Cancer could be an example of that. We look at all manner of reproductive effects, developmental effects. We look at effects on people's organs. We look at effects on the endocrine system. We're looking to see, always with every pesticide, what is its potential for causing a hazard? How does it go about doing that? If it does cause a hazard, what parts of a human or mammalian system might it affect? We also think about that not only in terms of adults, but we'll think about this in terms of infants and very young children. We'll think about it in terms of school-aged children. We'll think about it in terms of adolescents. We'll think about it in terms of young adults who are parents or parents-to-be. And then the part I'm increasingly more interested in, older people. And because we actually do know from a variety of different sources, depending on your age, where you are in life, your gender, the effects that a chemical might have on you will be different. So we actually try to look at all of that and factor that into our decision making. If we're looking at it on the environmental side, we will also try to look at what are the range of possible effects on aquatic plants, on birds, fish, aquatic invertebrate organisms, and both in the immediate acute sense as well as in terms of the chronic sense. So would it wipe out a whole population of plants in an aquatic environment and therefore undermine the health of an aquatic community because the basic food structure is no longer there? And we then, that's, I guess, pretty much sums up. We're trying to look for everything in terms of the potential for causing a hazard.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lindsay, could you describe a little further how you determine the method of exposure? You have described very clearly the range of influences that might come to bear on people, the environment, and so forth. How do you determine the areas or the possibilities for exposure? What are the kinds of contacts that are taken into consideration?
Ms. Lindsay?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, when a registrant brings a pesticide to us for registration, one of the things they have to do is identify with a pretty high degree of precision what do they want their product used for. And so they couldn't just say corn, but they would have to say, this is a corn herbicide, I want to use it before corn emerges, I want to use it at this application rate, this time of year, in this part of the country. And it could be wherever corn is grown, it could be in some subset of where corn is grown. We have a variety of other data sources that actually will tell us, depending on where we're, what use site, relevant geographic climatic factors. We have models, for instance, that help us assess if it's going to be used in Florida, what are the rainfall events that might lead to the dispersal of the chemical through the environment. It's actually a little bit like a long time ago when I was a kid in school, I get these, in math class, I get these storybook problems, and the hard part was actually figuring out what were the questions you had to ask in order to put all the information together and come up with the right answer that you'd have 5 cents left. Well, when the pesticide is brought to us, we basically have to sort of say to ourselves, if we let this product onto the market, where will it be? How much will be there? How long will it be there? How frequently will it be there? What are all of the other factors in the natural world, in the man-made world, that will change and impact that? And how might those factors do that? And so we call this a sort of a problem formulation stage, which is why I was comparing it to sort of the storybook problems.
Ms. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Lindsay, so this would mean that in the comprehensive approach to studying a particular pesticide, that there would be questions as to how this might be conveyed through the air, through the water, through the food product itself. Does it also include buildup in human tissue or animal tissue over time? Could you describe a little bit about how those studies are followed through?
Ms. Lindsay.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, yes. A number of those 100 studies that I referred to are specifically designed, first of all, to identify what I would call the environmental fate characteristics of a chemical. So you need to know, if you put it out in the environment, how long will it stay there? And also, if I put it out in the environment in a colder clime as opposed to almost a tropical environment such as Florida or a dry environment in the Southwest, how long will it stay? Because those different climates can actually affect how long a pesticide might last. And we also have another set of studies that are designed to sort of say, and if you have a rainfall event, if it rains, will the pesticide move off the field where it was applied and go into the water, and then what happens to it when it gets in the water? Does it actually go down to the sediment and bind into the sediment? Does it not do that? There are all kinds of questions that our scientists ask about the basic movement of a pesticide in the environment, and the studies that we require are designed in a systematic way to give us that information.
Representative
Johnson. Well, thank you.
Any other questions before we move on? Okay, if you could please continue, Ms. Lindsay.
Okay. Atrazine is one of the most well-examined pesticides in the marketplace. We are actively reviewing atrazine as part of our re-registration program. There are nearly 6,000 studies in our files on the human health and environmental effects of atrazine. We used these data to produce our preliminary risk assessment of atrazine in 2001. And after considering comments through our public review process, we issued a revised risk assessment for comment in 2002. We released a regulatory position in an interim registration eligibility document in January 2003 and revised that document again in October 2003 to reflect new data. EPA is statutorily required to reach a decision on atrazine's eligibility for re-registration by August 3, 2006. One of the areas that has been an area of significant debate is whether atrazine might cause cancer. And I think this is a good example of how we try to deal with difficult scientific issues. In 2000, after reviewing various rat studies, these are studies conducted in the laboratory on rats as test animals, these studies for atrazine showed that it did indeed produce tumors in rats.
We asked our scientific advisory panel to review our determination that atrazine was a potential human carcinogen. That was our tentative conclusion at that point in time. The scientific advisory panel, however, disagreed with our conclusion, saying that on the basis of available human epidemiology studies, as well as multiple types of tests in laboratory animals, they did not expect atrazine to act as a human carcinogen. We took those recommendations from our scientific advisory panel, went back, reexamined the data we had, rethought our work, and ultimately revised a risk assessment to reflect the conclusions of the scientific advisory panel. However, the subject of carcinogenicity with regard to atrazine was not settled at that point. In 2001, the registrant, the principal registrant, Syngenta, informed EPA that a study of their workers showed an elevated level of prostate cancer. Syngenta claimed that the higher incidence of prostate cancer was due to the health program they had in place that screened virtually every worker for prostate cancer in a manufacturing facility of theirs in Louisiana. This is a rate of screening, actually, they claim, much higher than is generally common. EPA reviewed these data on prostate cancer, and because of the difficulty in interpreting the data, sought review again by our scientific advisory panel of this epidemiological work. We also at that time provided our panel with the results from the agricultural health study, which showed no association between atrazine and prostate cancer. This agricultural health study is actually being conducted by another arm of the federal government, the National Institutes of Health, and is the largest study of pesticides and cancer ever performed. I should note, actually, it's not totally finished. It's such a large study. It has many times the several hundred workers in Syngenta's manufacturing facility. The scientific advisory panel agreed that some or all of the apparent increase in prostate cancer associated with the Louisiana plant was due to the intensive health screening, but they were not persuaded fully that that was the only reason. And therefore, they believed it was incumbent on us and Syngenta to do more study and analysis, and we are actually implementing those panel recommendations. Turning to the issues associated with frogs and amphibians, we have used a similar approach to trying to resolve the controversy over whether atrazine harms frogs. Altogether, we've evaluated this at this point 17 different laboratory and field studies, which include research by Dr. Hayes, but also research done by Syngenta and others, reporting that, in Dr. Hayes' case, that atrazine causes a mixture of sex organs in a single animal, so the frog would not be what you would expect a normal frog to be. The agency used this information to actually prepare a 95-page white paper on potential developmental effects of atrazine on amphibians, which is supported by over 35 different scientific references. Our paper found that all of the available information, all of those 17 studies, regardless of who conducted them, were scientifically flawed. And I need to stress that. Each and every one of those studies had significant flaws. Therefore, we felt in this paper and articulated it there that no firm conclusions could be drawn about whether atrazine actually affects frog sexual development, and if so, at what levels. You simply couldn't draw a valid conclusion. None of the laboratory studies were conducted in accordance with standard aquatic toxicity protocols that were developed by a society for developing these methods over 20 years ago. And I will note that the protocols that we're referring to talk about what I would refer to as animal husbandry. How do you need to actually keep the frog for the duration of the study to make sure that the water is flowing appropriate, that there's the nutrient loading is not too much. All of those things can actually have an effect on the frog in addition to the chemical that you may be trying to test. So these protocols have been around for a long time, but none of these studies actually followed those standard protocols for conducting aquatic toxicity studies.
Consequently, because of all of the flaws in all of the studies, we concluded that it was not possible to determine whether laboratory conditions independent of atrazine were responsible for the effects observed or the lack thereof. You simply cannot tell when you look at those studies, either individually or together, what was causing the effects that were described. The agency also concluded that due to serious flaws, all of the field studies had limited usefulness in assessing the effects of atrazine on wild frogs' developments. An example of the problems noted were that the designation of control sites in some of the studies actually had higher concentrations of atrazine than the sites that were the experimental sites. There was also a failure to evaluate the potential impact of non-chemical stressors, such as nutrient loading or habitat conditions. So again, with the field studies, you cannot single out what was causing whatever effects were observed. It's not possible to tell that from these studies. In sum, because of the pervasive problems that we found with all of the data, we concluded that while the research did raise questions about possible effects on frogs, scientifically valid conclusions could not be drawn with the level of confidence scientists routinely expect to have. Nevertheless, these questions are worthy of further investigation, and to ensure the credibility and soundness of additional research, we also went on to develop a 5-phase research proposal that's outlined in that white paper. We took this white paper to our scientific advisory panel to obtain an independent, objective, expert review of our conclusions. But before I actually go into that process, I want to address a widely reported and erroneous set of statements that allege that the conclusions of this particular scientific advisory panel are not credible because of the conflict of interest of its chairman, Dr. Ron Kendall. One critic is quoted as saying, "Talk about conflict of interest. Not only was Dr. Kendall on the Syngenta payroll and chairing the EPA panel, he was running the lab that did all of Syngenta's work." This allegation is untrue in one critical respect. Dr. Kendall never served on any scientific advisory panel that reviewed atrazine for any reason. He was not on the panel that evaluated the white paper on the amphibian data. In fact, because he performed research for Syngenta, Dr. Kendall recused himself from participation on any matter involving atrazine or any other pesticide registered by Syngenta during his tenure on the scientific advisory panel, which ended in December 2002. Thus, while Dr. Kendall did appear as a private citizen to present his and others' research results at the June 2003 panel meeting, Dr. Kendall was no longer the chairman or even a member of the scientific advisory panel at that time. He did not serve on, much less chair the panel, or otherwise participate in the panel's deliberations on the effects of atrazine on amphibian species.
Ms. Lindsay, you're letting facts get in the way of some good stories.
No? Those who want to tell stories will.
Please continue.
Following standard procedures to ensure impartiality, EPA carefully screened a large pool of candidates to identify leading experts in relevant fields to serve on that panel. Ethics officials examined financial disclosure statements to uncover any conflicts of interest and interviewed candidates for any other reasons to believe that they might have a pre-existing bias. EPA eventually selected a panel of 15 members from government and academic institutions around the world, including Dr. Carl Richards with the University of Minnesota at Duluth. The panel held a 3-day meeting, which included 3 hours of EPA presentations, over 4 hours of presentation by Dr. Hayes, as well as presentations by others, including Syngenta researchers. After hearing the presentations, the panel discussed publicly their responses to the scientific issues. As quoted in my longer testimony that I'm not reading from, there's a direct quote there. "The scientific advisory panel endorsed fully EPA's conclusions about the problems with the existing data on atrazine's effects on frogs. The scientific advisory panel also endorsed the agency's 5-phase research proposal for getting definitive data." Since then, Syngenta has initiated the required phase one studies following an EPA review of their protocol. These studies should establish whether exposure to atrazine can actually cause changes in gonadal development of frogs. A report on this research is due to EPA early in 2006. When we receive, we will review these results as, so that we can incorporate them into our decision on atrazine for August 2006. Positive results, if they're demonstrated in this study, could trigger regulatory restrictions and or additional research so that we would understand better how atrazine might actually be having any effects if they were noted in this first phase. It's been claimed that research on frogs actually shows that atrazine causes changes in the production of aromatase, which is an enzyme that's involved in the conversion of testosterone, a male hormone, to estrogen, a female hormone. It's also been claimed that other scientists have shown similar effects in other species. Based on the similarity of the metabolic systems across species, it's also been argued that atrazine might disrupt the functioning of the human endocrine system, leading to such adverse effects as breast cancer. EPA does not agree that the available frog research shows the effects of atrazine on the frog endocrine system, and thus the likelihood for similar outcomes in humans. Those studies raise a hypothesis. They are not evidence that atrazine causes effects on frogs. There is no direct scientific information to actually assess this hypothesis at this point in time. That's why we required the phase one research that Syngenta is conducting. In the absence of such information, we've considered these theories and we've concluded that it's really not supported by the overall weight of the evidence on the toxicity of atrazine in mammalian tests, nor is it consistent with available human data. First, the agricultural health study has found no association between breast cancer and exposure to atrazine. Second, the scientific advisory panel has reviewed the available data on how experimental animals handle atrazine and concluded that atrazine is not likely to be carcinogenic in humans. We are prepared, of course, to re-examine this conclusion at any time in the light of new scientific information, and we do take action when we have information that convinces us action is necessary. So to conclude, there is an active debate about the safety of atrazine. After a very careful assessment, EPA's current view is that the available studies do not adequately demonstrate such effects. A panel of independent external experts, the scientific advisory panel, supports our conclusions. At the same time, we hope it's clear that the agency is committed to fully understanding whether atrazine has the potential to harm amphibians and humans. To resolve these questions, EPA has required new research. We are monitoring the progress of this ongoing research closely, and we will analyze all of these data as they become available. Finally, if data shows atrazine harms wildlife or humans, EPA will aggressively pursue regulatory measures necessary to ensure atrazine will be used only if it is safe for people and the environment.
Thank you. With that, we'll start with questions. I have a question. As this debate's been going on, there's stories all over the place. We're hearing that atrazine's been banned in all of Europe and around the world. Where has atrazine actually been banned?
Mr. Chair, it is true that the European Union made a decision in the last couple of years to ban the use of atrazine. EPA is actually in touch with other pesticide regulators worldwide on, frankly, a daily basis. So that one of the ways in which we quality control and check our work is to talk with our regulatory colleagues in Europe and Australia, Canada, pretty much everywhere in the world that has a regulatory system that's similar in scope to ours. In the U.S., the system we use is actually a risk-based system. The reason we require all of those studies is so we actually know what risks a pesticide can pose. We can know what levels those risks are likely to occur at, and we can know what levels of exposure people are actually getting. When the level of exposure that people are getting is well below the level of risk, our usual regulatory decision is to permit the use of the pesticide, all other things being equal. In Europe, particularly with regard to water resources, they take a very different approach to regulation. So they will be working with the same scientific data. Frankly, we know that by and large, we pretty much evaluate the data in the same way because of our close contacts and relationships with Europe.
But they have a policy-based framework for water protection, and they've established a level, a 0.1 parts per million level, and have made a decision that any pesticide that would get into water above that level, whether or not there's a risk, will not be permitted. And so the basis for the European decision, as it's been explained to me by my European colleagues, is not a risk basis, it's a policy-based decision that the residues that would be found would be above 0.1, and by policy, that's not permitted. Very different approach than the approach we take in the U.S. for our decision making.
Are there any states in the United States that have had a ban, instituted a ban?
I believe that there are individual states that have taken a variety of measures to deal with water quality issues, not just specific to atrazine, but to other chemicals that may get into water. But I'm not aware of another state that has totally banned the use of atrazine. But I will be honest that I didn't actually check that before I came.
I've always thought you were honest. I'm not questioning your honesty. President Pennis and then Erdahl. President Pennis? You were talking about atrazine out of order, totally out of order.
I am sorry, Mr. Chair.
Now you are in order.
I'm in order now.
Yeah,
well, boy, I fooled you. Mr. Chair and testifier, one of the questions I had, and I think I found it already in here, was how, why was statement made that Dr. Hayes' studies were scientifically flawed and... But maybe it would be good if you said them anyway, some of the reasons.
Ms. Lindsay?
Okay, Mr. Chairman and Representative Penis. The flaws that were seen actually in all of the studies have to do with just the basic conduct of the study. And so all kinds of procedures that have been developed to ensure that your experimental animal, in this case the frog, is well taken care of and is not suffering adverse effects because there might not be enough oxygen in the water or there may be too much sort of food in the water or they're having some other kind of stress. As I understand it from folks who are experts in amphibians, in test conditions, all of those kinds of things can actually have an adverse effect on frogs. So these animal husbandry procedures are designed to prevent that from happening so that you can actually tell, is it a chemical that might be causing an effect, the chemical you want to test, as opposed to just bad, if you're a farmer, bad livestock maintenance. It's like having, I don't know, a herd of cattle and not taking care of them right, and they get sick. The laboratory studies had all kinds of problems like that. Each one were slightly different, but they had those sorts of problems. In addition, there was a lack of what I would call use of consistent terminology. So as the different researchers reported the effects that they apparently saw in the study, they used different terms and ways to describe it. So it was very hard to actually compare from one study to the next with one researcher actually describing the same thing as another was, and there seemed to be no way to unravel that inconsistency in terminology. Studies in the field had similarly serious flaws, so that your control site, where you're really trying to sort of say, what will happen to the frog when they're not being exposed to the chemical or the stressor you're trying to test? You've got a comparison. The unstressed frog versus the stressed. In at least one of these field studies, what should have been the unstressed frog actually was exposed to higher levels of atrazine than the wild frogs that were being tested. So there are actually many more design flaws, and if you went back and read our 95-page white paper or any of our other document, that there's lots. And I've just kind of hit the highlights and...
Ms. Lindsay, could I get a copy of that 95-page document?
Absolutely.
So that Craig can read it?
And give you the report.
And I know, seriously, I would like a copy.
Yeah. I will note, all of this is actually on our website, but I'll actually make sure that Craig gets his copy.
Don't expect me to get
copy.
It on the website. Okay, Representative Pennis, anything else?
No, I think I'll...
Okay, Representative Erdahl.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Lindsay... The EPA has concluded that atrazine is not likely to cause cancer. Are there other countries or other organizations that have come forward to support that conclusion?
Ms. Lindsay?
Mr. Chair and Representative Urdahl, I don't know at this point in time that there really are. In Europe, rather than coming out with a final document that discussed all of these issues, because they were able to make their policy decision, they simply made their policy decision. And I'm not sure in some of the other countries where specifically they are in their reevaluation process.
Representative Urdahl?
That's all. Thank you.
One question, then we'll go to Representative Wealthy. One question I have is, Representative Johnson. One question I have is, why are we going from amphibians to humans? Why wouldn't we go from mammals to humans? Tests on mammals. Why are they testing the frogs to see what we're going to do? Aren't we more like rats? Or pigs or gorillas or something? I mean, why? What's the connection? Why would you go from amphibians to humans rather than, you said you tested on rats, you know, mammal. Why wouldn't you do it that way?
Mr. Chair, typically when you're at a regulatory agency like ours, or say at the Food and Drug Administration, if you're trying to identify the potential hazards that a chemical could cause people, you will use a series of studies in mammals, which would include rats, it may include dogs, mice, sometimes some other mammals, but that typically is it. And you do extrapolate from those animals. There's a basic assumption that because we're all mammals, what you see in an animal study is relevant to humans. Although as you actually study in more detail how a chemical may actually work its effect, you also realize that sometimes a system in a rat that simply doesn't exist in a human being. So although you see an effect in a rat, such as the tumors that we saw in the rat studies for atrazine, you know, because the human body works differently, that effect's not relevant. But one of our other responsibilities is to actually examine effects on wildlife. And so we also require a series of studies, not typically on frogs. We didn't actually require initially either Syngenta or anyone else to do studies on frogs. We typically ask for them on fish, bluegill and rainbow trout, for example, on birds, mallards, bobwhite quail, and some aquatic invertebrates. And that's to help us actually figure out what's the impact on wildlife or what's the impact on plants. But the argument that people are making is that frogs, too, have some relevance to human beings. So if you're seeing potentially adverse effects in frogs, they may have relevance to human beings. So when we look at the whole body of data, we don't just sort of say, this is only for wildlife and this is only for people. We actually look at the whole body and use it to inform our judgment, both for purposes of protecting people as well as for purposes of protecting the environment. We try to get the maximum out of the data.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Representative Welty, then Pennis. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lindsay, I have a question on the back of the page and the handout that you gave for your statement. You just stated that Syngenta has initiated the required Phase 1 studies. And I'm just wondering what you mean by initiated. Are they voluntarily supporting the study, and then are they paying for it, and then it's being done by an independent research organization or firm? Or just what specifically, can you give me a little bit of background on the study that's being done that will result in some statements in August of 2006?
Ms. Lindsay?
Mr. Chair and Representative Welty. The phase one work, we have an official process. We actually refer to it as a data call-in system. The law allows us to require a manufacturer to provide studies that we believe we need to evaluate a pesticide. So the phase one study that we've required has been required through that data call-in process, and Syngenta is required to submit it to us. We also, because of the importance of making sure that the work was done well, asked
to review the protocol for that phase one work, and we have done so, and we have provided our comments to Syngenta. It is Syngenta's responsibility to actually get those studies conducted and to do that through whatever mechanisms and laboratories they find to be most appropriate. We're expecting the study results we receive to conform to the protocol that we reviewed, and we will review those studies rigorously, but it is Syngenta's choice how they actually get the studies conducted. And that's the Congress has said that the registrant must bear that burden of conducting the studies. It is expensive and not something that the taxpayers should be paying for directly.
Representative Welty. Ms. Lindsay, would you say that these frog studies are, they can study anything they want to, and that makes sense, I guess, but I was trying to find a link here where they're comparing it to damage to a frog as to damage a human being. Are the frogs the canary in the mine shaft for atrazine here? I mean, is that why they're talking about frogs all the time? I mean, are they saying if it gets a frog, it might get us, or what are they saying here?
Mr. Chair, people have said, that's the assertion that I was trying to address towards the end of my testimony, that if you do see endocrine effects in frogs, that they're basically signaling that there's a problem for people and for other animals. And it is true that all of us have endocrine systems, so that if you see evidence of an endocrine effect in one species, I think that ought to be very carefully noted and thought through and investigated with regard to its relevance to another species, including people. The problem here with the frog studies is they're not that evidence. They've raised a question, and it's a very important question that needs to be answered, but it's not evidence of endocrine effects.
Representative Pennis, and then Otremba, and then Johnson. Representative Pennis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is, atrazine, how many pesticides do we have atrazine in? And can you give us some other examples, or some that we have in Minnesota, I guess? Because it's not just one, right? There are other pesticides with atrazine in. So. How many others about than...
Ms. Lindsay?
Mr. Chair and Representative Penis, I actually don't know the number of individual products that contain atrazine at the federal level, and I don't know whether my colleague from Minnesota knows the answer for the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is one piece of data that I did not bring with me, but I do know that there are multiple products with either the sole active ingredient of atrazine or a mixture of atrazine with another herbicide. So I think the safe answer is that there are a number of products in Minnesota that have atrazine as an active ingredient at various percentage levels.
Thank you.
Representative? Okay, Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the way that you have...
Oh, time out. Excuse me. We're getting hand signals. Mr. Bazig, why don't you come down and put that on the record? Here, whatever you're doing. What were you doing? I wasn't paying attention. Was there a question? Mr. Bazig, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, Greg Bazig, Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Staff enforcement that there's 90 products registered with atrazine in the state of Minnesota.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. 90. Okay, that's why we have them come down. I'm sorry, Representative Otremba.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate in your document that the EPA, does not agree emphatically, and there's no scientific information, and that you are actually looking at new research. As I have studied the issue of cancer for a long time, in the early 70s, there were many things that were told that there was nothing wrong. I use the example of my husband. He was exposed to radiation for years at a time, and there was nothing that would connect them to any ill. 20 years later, he had cancer, and 30 years later, they now say that, yes, absolutely, that's the cause. And so I appreciate what you're saying, that it's not conclusive, but I also appreciate that you're looking at new research, because many of the cancers are not found for a generation later.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Kremba. Johnson, and then Mo, and then if there's no other questions, we'll go into some comments from the Department of Agriculture. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lindsay, back to frogs again. I live down the road, but I think upstream, I hope, from a frog study that was done by some school kids about 10 years ago near Henderson, Minnesota. And there was a good deal of back and forth on what might be the causes of the frog deformities. Extra legs, I think, was the story, including the things that might be in the water or ultraviolet rays. Can you give us an update on that particular examination of frog abnormalities?
Ms. Lindsay or Mr. Lamont, or do we have anyone here that could answer that? Wasn't it parasites? Ms. Lindsay?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, I'm very limited. A disclaimer, I'm not an amphibian expert. You've probably guessed that by now, actually. As I understand it, because I did talk with our folks before I came out here about that issue, and I don't know that there's really a definitive answer as to what is going on with that phenomenon. It's different than the effects that were found, the frogs with more legs, the fewer legs, and other deformed limbs, somewhat different effects than the effects that have been alleged to occur in these studies that we've looked at. People have talked about, I think, actually ultraviolet radiation as being a possible cause, but as far as I know, there's not a definitive answer at this point in time.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lindsay, do you know if there is continuing evaluation of that particular phenomenon, or is that a closed book?
Ms. Lindsay.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, I believe there are scientists who are continuing to look at the issue because, so far as I know, there's not an indication that it's actually pesticides causing that particular phenomenon. We at the Office of Pesticide Programs have not initiated further work on that front, but we stay abreast of it so that if, in fact, it did show something that we should be concerned about, we would be aware of it in real time and be able to deal with that.
Johnson.
Thank you.
Representative Mull.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Lindsay, you know, I don't care at all frogs that much, with all due respect to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Johnson. You know, but I don't catch and eat frogs. I mean, maybe I did when I was a kid, but nowadays, you know, we're concerned in Minnesota about top predators in the lakes, walleye, pike, muskie, where and other things have bioaccumulated, and we have fish advisories, which is an economic issue for where I'm from. Is there going to be consideration, I talked about it a little bit in looking at wildlife, but is there a consideration in the study to ultimately, how is this going to affect, you know, the top fish predators in our ecosystem, the one that many of our economies are dependent upon, and will that be ultimately in part of your study?
Ms. Lindsay.
Mr. Chair and Representative Moe, yeah. In addition to the Phase 1 frog research that we have required Syngenta to do, we have also required them to initiate an ecological monitoring program for sensitive watersheds, and it's focused particularly on the aquatic plant community. There are 40 watersheds that have been identified for this study. And the reason we're focusing on the aquatic plants, or we've asked Syngenta to focus on the aquatic plants, is we know that if aquatic plants in a watershed are destroyed at a significant level, that you will then have impacts all the way up the chain, and eventually, if nothing were done, you would have sort of a collapse of the aquatic ecosystem in that particular watershed, and it could have effects on the predator species like the walleye that are at the top of that particular chain. And because atrazine is a herbicide, it very clearly has effects on plants. So Syngenta is in the process of putting into place, and so Syngenta is in the process of putting into place and conducting a monitoring program for 40 most sensitive watersheds, so we can
answer that kind of question. And if in fact at any point during this monitoring program we start seeing effects of concern, part of the other requirement on Syngenta is to immediately begin to take action to put into place what we call a watershed management program. And if they need to do that, we expect them to actually do that in concert with the relevant state authorities and infrastructure that's already in place. So if that were to happen in Minnesota, we would expect them to be working with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, other relevant Minnesota agencies, to put a watershed management program into place to ensure that the effects didn't continue to occur at that significant level. These 40 watersheds that are the most sensitive were actually selected from a larger universe of about 1,000 watersheds that we know have vulnerability in this regard. And they were selected in such a way that they're statistically representative of that larger group. So if, in fact, when the monitoring is done, not only would there be sort of immediate action to protect an individual watershed in the 40, but if we saw that there was a really significant impact in all of the 40 or many of the 40, that would tell us something about this larger universe and that there was additional work that needed to be done. This, I think, is probably a one-of-a-kind monitoring effort. It is very substantial. It's actually started for corn and sorghum production. I believe that there is actually a watershed in Minnesota that will be part of that program, although I don't think the work has started there yet. I think it will start in later in 2005 and run for a two-year period.
Where?
I knew you were going to ask me that, and I've just looked it out of my head, but I've got the answer. If you give me a minute, it'll come back to me. It's in... Sorry. Whitewater North Fork in Olmsted and Wabasha counties. Yeah.
That's actually in Winona County, isn't it? Whitewater.
North Fork.
Not the land deal in Arkansas. That's North Fork. That probably goes up into Wabasha. Yeah.
Anyway, but your question is very pertinent, and we believe that that kind of a monitoring program will actually give us the answers that are needed, either that those effects aren't happening with regard to the use of atrazine, or if they are, what it is that needs to be done to make sure that they don't continue to occur.
Quick follow-up, Tim Ball.
Yeah, so then the EPA would have regulatory authority to enforce that management plan, whatever that was.
Yeah.
Okay, with that, I'll have a few comments from Mr. Paul Lamont. If you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Yes, Paul Lamont, Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I am going to be very brief. I thought it would be of interest to know the relationship between the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and the U.S. EPA for those of you who do not already know. First off, there is a federal pesticide law, and Ann Lindsay referred to it as FIFRA. We also have a Minnesota state pesticide law, and that's Chapter 18D for enforcement and inspection purposes, and 18B for registration and proper use and storage and so forth. The Minnesota law goes much further into managing the risks of pesticides than the FIFRA law does, because we have provisions that regulate use, handling, storage, distribution, disposal, and as some of you know, a cleanup program for spills. We rely entirely on the label directions that are U.S. EPA approved via the registration process. Our work together for regulatory compliance monitoring is done according to a cooperative agreement with U.S. EPA. Those cooperative agreements are authorized in Minnesota Statutes Chapter 18B. EPA, I will not fail to mention it, fortunately subsidizes some of that work through a grant to us from the federal government. As part of that cooperative agreement and grant, we have to do reporting and we have to be accountable for our activities. If we have problems and issues, we report those to EPA. And in fact, I've had the privilege and pleasure the last couple of years of chairing a committee that's made up of state representatives like myself that meets with EPA several times a year to talk about issues involving pesticide registrations, pesticide use issues, and so forth. Ms. Lindsay mentioned to me this morning that it may be worthwhile to tell you that that cooperative relationship goes so far that 2 years ago, one of our top staff hydrologists who conducted the Minnesota groundwater pesticide monitoring program went on detail at the request of US EPA and spent a year in Washington telling them how Minnesota was doing its groundwater monitoring. So I think the legislature and this committee can be very happy with the status of our regulatory program in partnership as described by Ms. Lindsay. Essentially, that's all I wanted to bring to your attention. We do not do risk assessment per se, certainly nowhere near what you saw or heard described today and what you see in the papers presented to you. On a pesticide-by-pesticide basis, we do perform some risk assessment that's normally at this time in regard to water quality issues and use management.
Thank you. Ms. Lindsay, and I will go to Representative Pennis. Ms. Lindsay, how's Minnesota doing? How are we doing okay?
Mr. Chair, Minnesota's actually got a very credible pesticide regulatory program, and we view them as one of the leaders among state regulatory officials. They have a sense of responsibility not only to the citizens of Minnesota, but frankly to the whole country. They share their expertise, their knowledge, their insights with other state pesticide regulatory officials, as well as you can tell with the US EPA.
And we're pretty good.
You're very good.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. How many individual licensed pesticide applicators are there in Minnesota? I mean, those that take the pesticide test, just a rough number.
Mr. Lamont?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me. I think I'd be safe in saying about 7,000 to 8,000 commercial pesticide applicators. There's another fairly large group of non-commercial applicators that do that sort of work as part of their employment.
Right.
Many of the DNR and DOT employees are non-commercial applicators. And then we have a much smaller number in some categories like structural pest control and aquatic pest control. Additionally, it's never without mention that in Minnesota right now we have at least 20,000, perhaps a bit more, of what we call certified private pesticide applicators, and those are the farmers that have taken training and now have a certification to purchase and use restricted use pesticides.
Representative?
Good answer.
Representative Erdahl?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'd just like to mention to the witnesses and those who are interested that certainly this is a very important topic, and appreciate Chair David's asking the question about what Minnesota is doing, and glad to hear that we're doing a pretty good job here. But there's always more that can be done, and we have I've introduced a bill this year to monitor groundwater in Minnesota and to include some more funding for that. And hopefully we'll be able to get that through and aid the monitoring some more here in Minnesota.
Any other questions for either witness, Representative Otremba?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bouncing up. How do you decide which pesticides are okay for Minnesota? You said that there were 20,000 at the federal level that are, and then another, I think you said, 10,000 or 12,000. How do you decide
that these will work in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tremba, the decision is based on their applying for registration, paying appropriate fees, perhaps reporting their sales after the fact if they rise to a certain level and paying additional fees. There are some products, a small group of products that are approved for use in aquatic sites in Minnesota, and we consult with the Minnesota DNR. And of the many products that may contain that approved use by Minnesota DNR consultation, that list is very, very small. So they have sub-selected. But that would be essentially the criteria for registering a product for distribution and use in Minnesota.
Well, the topography of Minnesota is different. You know, if there's a lot of water in some areas does that have an effect? Are there certain areas of the state where you can't use certain pesticides, or is it pretty much across the board?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tremba, we have not instituted state restrictions beyond what is on pesticide product labeling. Many pesticide product labels, which are the end result of the sophisticated process you just heard described, will contain use directions that they cannot be used within so many feet, or do not allow them to enter, or are approved for use within water supplies within a certain dosage range. So we depend upon the U.S. EPA approved label and the use directions thereon.
There's 22% of the water is in and around my area, so I'm always concerned about whether or not some of these should be used just because they're state approved and maybe not around water. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Trimble. Okay, with that, I would really like to thank Ms. Lindsay, for coming from Washington, D.C., and the Department of Agriculture. If you have any questions, go to their website, I guess. That'd be a good place to do it. But I do want that 95-page deal.
We'll get that to you.
With that, good government all the time, we are adjourned.